From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Olympic gold medalist Greg Louganis. He's the first prominent athlete to tell the public that he contracted HIV from a homosexual relationship. We'll talk with Louganis about his health, his decision to come out, and his extraordinary diving career. Also, filmmaker Milcho Manchevski talks about his native Macedonia. His new film, Before the Rain, is partially set in the former Yugoslav Republic that is at risk of being pulled into the Balkan War. The film has been nominated for an Academy Award. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Polish Officer, a new espionage novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Senate has rejected the balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. Democratic opponents say they would have supported it if Republicans had promised to protect Social Security from the budget acts. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole says he finds that reason a little hard to believe.
I must say I've been a little bit amused, I guess you would say, about all this talk on the other side about Social Security, particularly after most every Democrat in 1993 voted to increase taxes on Social Security recipients to the tune of about $25 billion. It affected millions and millions of retired people. So I must say I was a bit amused when I see all the gnashing of the teeth.
President Clinton says Congress can and must now cut the deficit under established budget procedures. He says when he took office, he quickly acted to cut the deficit, but he says the Republican-led Congress hasn't revealed its plans.
In 1993, though I had never before been a part of government in Washington, we presented our budget plan only 27 days into our administration. It has now been 57 days since the Republicans took control of the Congress. And even though their leadership has been here many, many more years, they have still not presented their budget. We passed the budget resolution for our plan before the legal deadline of April the 15th. Now they must follow that process as well. Telling the American people how they are going to keep the promises of their contract on balancing the budget and paying for their tax cuts by the legal deadline of April the 15th.
Senator Dole says he will bring the balanced budget amendment back for another vote when lawmakers are in the middle of their re-election campaigns. Leaders of both political parties have issued sharply different statements on the value of public radio and television. A key congressional committee is considering cuts for public broadcasting today. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich was first off the mark. Asked about today's session of the House Appropriations Committee, Gingrich said he was discouraged and saddened by the attitude of the whole public broadcasting bureaucracy.
I think there's a certain sort of petulant immaturity just saying, give us more money. Let's not talk about any reform.
Later, in a speech at American University, Vice President Al Gore said that Republican reforms were actually an attempt to kill public broadcasting. Borrowing a well-known technique from Mr. Rogers, the vice president said that the attacks make American parents want to sit Republican leaders down and ask them,
can you say children? Can you say education? We want their response.
This is Neil Conan in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen more than 18 points to 3,976. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. The Federal Reserve has moved into the foreign exchange market to stop the dollar's slide against the Japanese yen. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York, acting on orders from the Treasury Department, purchased an undetermined amount of dollars and sold yen and German marks. Analysts say investors are worried about the impact of the Mexican economic crisis on the United States, and they aren't interested in holding dollars. Two women were killed and a third critically injured in a courthouse in Seattle today. Paula Whistle of member station KPLU reports.
According to witnesses, the three women were sitting on a bench outside a family courtroom when a man came up and fired five or six shots. The two women who died suffered head and chest wounds. The man who was apprehended was apparently involved in a divorce proceeding against one of the women. All of the courts have now been closed for the day. The incident has renewed efforts here to improve courthouse security. Some county lawmakers have opposed a move to ban all guns from the courthouse, saying such a move would violate citizens' Second Amendment rights to bear arms. For National Public Radio, I'm Paula Whistle at the King County Courthouse in Seattle.
U.S. and Italian Marines have abandoned Somali seaport in Mogadishu. They're pulling back in a convoy to the beaches, getting ready to leave. Witnesses say there have been shots and explosions near the pullout route. Marines shot two Somalis today after they fired at U.S. personnel from a pickup truck near the airport. No word on the condition of the Somalis. The Los Angeles City Council is ready to pay Rodney King's legal fees. The council approved a payment of nearly $1.7 million for King's lawyers. That's in addition to the $3.8 million a jury awarded King for injuries he suffered in his March 1991 beating by police. The beating was videotaped. The Grammy Awards were handed out last night. Best New Artist went to Sheryl Crow, who also received a Grammy for her song All I Want to Do, and the Best Female Pop Performance. Longtime entertainer Tony Bennett gathered two Grammy Awards as well. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last month, Olympic diving champion Greg Louganis became the first prominent athlete to disclose that he contracted HIV from a gay relationship. Louganis has written a memoir that elaborates on how his public image has contrasted with his real life. It's called Breaking the Surface. Louganis won two gold medals in 1984 and picked up two more in 1988. Those 88 gold medals were remarkable, considering what happened in the preliminaries. During one dive on the descent from his somersaults, he hit his head on the diving board. He emerged from the water bleeding. A doctor stitched Louganis' wound, and he was back on the board minutes later. Neither the doctor nor the millions of people watching knew what Greg Louganis had found out 5 months earlier. He was HIV positive. I asked Greg Louganis about his energy level and mental state during the Olympics.
The lead up to that was probably more difficult because, you know, I had to go to work out. I was in training. I was harboring this secret that I couldn't tell anyone, eventually telling my coach. It was very, very difficult. If I didn't have a workout, then I'd stay home with, you know, depressed and pull the covers over my head. Once we got to the Olympics, you know, you go to the Olympics or even the Olympic trials, you are so focused. You know, I knew the job that I had to do and I had to do it and I had to, you know, be prepared both physically and mentally.
At what point in your dive did you realize the dive was going bad?
As I was taking off the board, I knew that my weight was back towards the board as I was taking off the board. I was afraid that I'd hit my hand on the board. I wasn't afraid of hitting my head because I didn't think I would be that close. So when I came out, I came with my arms very close to my body so that, you know, so that they would miss the board. But then I heard this big hollow thud and then I went crashing in the water and I realized that I had just hit my head.
So when you realized that you hit your head, what went through your mind?
Embarrassment is probably the first thing that, first emotion that I felt. And then, you know, I got rather angry with myself. I didn't want anybody to touch me. I pushed people away and held my hand over my head to try and keep the blood in.
One of the big controversies that surround your story now is that you didn't tell the doctor who took care of you at the Olympics that you were HIV positive, even though you were bleeding. Why didn't you tell him?
It's so difficult. I mean, to put it in perspective, you know, imagine yourself in the most, you know, unbelievably stressful situation and, you know, multiply that by 100 and then, you know, have the entire world, you know, looking at you through a microscope. You know, it's very difficult. You know, why do we make some of the decisions that we make? I was paralyzed with fear. I didn't know what my responsibility was. And it scared me. And, you know, in that situation, you know, I don't know that I would have been able to, you know, obviously you're not thinking clearly because, you know, in a stressful situation like that, you know, it's, It's quick decisions. You know, I only had a few minutes to, you know, to get ready to get back up on the board. You know, my confidence was shattered as far as with regard to the competition, you know, and this is the Olympic Games.
Now that we know some of the things that were going through your mind during the Olympic dives, tell us what it was like after you hit your head and you got out, you went through this whole crisis knowing that you're HIV positive and, you know, that the doctor was stitching you up, and there you are back on the diving board again. Mm-hmm. You have at least two big secrets that you're keeping from everybody while the cameras are on you, and now you have to execute a perfect dive. So exactly how do you get centered enough to execute a perfect dive when you're going through all this turmoil?
Well, it was easier to focus on the dive. It was easier to focus on the dive rather than the HIV.
You know what I thought was interesting, too? In your book, you said that it was in a way easier to do that second dive because since you'd hurt yourself on the dive before, you were now like the underdog, and it was easier for you to compete as the underdog. You felt more comfortable that way.
I've always felt more comfortable, you know, in the underdog position. The one that was expected to win. I mean, people expected me to win every time I got up on the board at one juncture in my career after 84. And, you know, that's a tremendous pressure. It's a tremendous pressure. It was nice to go back to that, you know, to being the underdog. I had to learn how to be a competitor as well. Because that was like a progression, you know, evolution for me as well.
I have another question about keeping things secret. I assume that your publisher suggested that you wait to disclose your HIV status until the book came out so that the attention would promote the book. How did you feel about that, about keeping it a secret until then and timing it to coincide with sale of the book?
You know, going public about your HIV status is something that is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was an intense year of therapy and preparing for this time. I mean, I wanted my views to be able to looked at. It's a very complex issue. And I wanted the book to reflect that. And you know, I would have waited until the very last minute, you know, because I'm still adjusting, you know, to having that information out there.
So it was good. It was good for you to have the time to prepare.
Yeah, I needed the time to prepare, and which was really very difficult because on the eve of doing Barbara Walters, the Barbara Walters interview, which was the first member of the media that I talked to about my HIV status, my therapist passed away. He died from complications of Crohn's. He was preparing me for this, introducing me to various people in the gay community, getting me prepared mentally for what I was about to embark on. And that was a really difficult loss for me.
Greg Louganis is my guest, and he's written a new autobiography. In your book, you write that although you wouldn't talk about it to the press and you wouldn't say anything in public, that other divers knew that you were gay, and your teammates in the 1980 Olympics knew. And in fact, some of them didn't want to share a room with you because of it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a whole fagbuster campaign at one of the competitions. People kind of humming who are you going to call, and not finishing it. What I had to wake up to every morning. We're all in dorms, and so there's a community bathroom and shower area, and there was fag with the Ghostbuster sign through it on the mirrors and signs all over the dorm rooms.
These were other athletes doing this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, did you have...
Not everybody, though. Uh-huh. I mean, uh-huh. Not everybody. I mean, there were, you know, a number of of supporters that were incredible. I was at that competition. I thought, God, the whole world's against me. And it came down to the last dive, one of the major instigators of that whole Fagbuster campaign. He was beating me. And then I looked out into the crowd and I saw Lisa Trombley. Lisa Trombley Bradshaw, she married Mark Bradshaw, who was on the 1988 Olympic team with me. And she looked up at me and she gave me a thumbs up and a big smile. And I thought, my God, I'm not alone. Just, you know, that I had the support of someone in that crowd. And it, fortunately, it came out that I did a good enough dive to win. And that's what I always wanted to do, is let my performance, my diving speak for itself. And in a sense, I mean, that's what I allowed it to do.
It sounds in a way maybe you're even more focused on becoming a better diver because so much else about your life was subject to ridicule.
Yeah, I question whether I'd be, if I were better adjusted, whether I would have won 4 gold medals, you know.
Well, I think so many people who are really talented question whether, if it wasn't for what was perceived by others as their defects, if they wouldn't have developed the talent in the way that they had.
Yeah.
So, but it seems to me you were pretty cut off from a larger gay community during the years that you were publicly in the closet, and that any kind of support or advice that you could have gotten, you didn't get.
Right. Yeah, I mean, any of the hate mail or, you know, letters of disappointment, you know, during those years did come from the gay community, you know, because I wasn't out enough for them. They heard the rumors and all that, and I didn't necessarily, you know, I wasn't necessarily hiding around bushes, you know. It was just that I didn't discuss my sexual orientation to the press and the media.
So some people in the gay community were angry with you for that.
Mm-hmm.
Did they offer any convincing reasons to come out? Not convincing enough, I guess.
No. I was like, well, you know, if you're going to pay my bills, I mean, I've got... No, but
okay. Pay your bills. What did you think the consequences would be if you came out?
Well, with athletes, you have, you know, managers now and agents who are like encouraging you not to discuss your personal life, because if anybody finds out that you even have a personal life, straight or gay, whatever you're doing, I mean, you're going to be criticized and lose endorsements. I mean, that's what. You know, it's a perception that's out there, and you're fed this, and, you know, as an athlete, you know your sport, you don't know the business world, and, you know, you're going to the pool and working out and doing your job. So, of course, you're going to believe somebody who you think is an authority.
My guest is 4-time Olympic gold medal winner Greg Louganis. He's written a new memoir called Breaking the Surface. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Greg Louganis is my guest. You started off doing acrobatics and then started diving. And you write in your book that when you started diving, you had to give up acrobatics because in acrobatics you have to land on your feet, and diving you land on your head, and it was just really confusing which way you're supposed to go.
Oh, God, I remember that workout, too. At gymnastics, I was doing a front handspring front, and I was, like, doing a face drop into the mat each time. And I was like, I came back from that workout and a bloody nose. And it was horrible.
Yeah, well, you have to deal with gravity, I suppose, in a completely different way.
Yeah.
Tell me more about what the physical difference is when you know you're jumping and you're diving into water head first, and when you're doing somersaults or whatever and you know you need to land on your feet.
Yeah, it's an orientation thing, like a kinesthetic awareness. I guess I found an easier time with finding my head rather than my feet.
Mm-hmm. You know, reading this made me think about how I've always been afraid to dive. I never learned how to dive. I can jump into water from any height, but I could just never bring myself to go head first, even into water.
Well, you have a pool around in your area. We'll meet there, okay?
Yeah, right.
I'll give you lessons.
What would you tell me? What would you tell me?
What do you do? Do you lift
me?
Your head and then...
Like, oh, I haven't even tried it since I was a kid. No, no.
Not even off the side of the pool?
Mm-mm. No, I what am I afraid of? I don't know. I just couldn't bring my body to do it. I'm afraid of, like, water rushing into my ears or it hurting too much on my stomach. I took a couple of real belly flops when I was a kid.
You're probably just lifting your head. You have to keep your head down and and look, back towards from where you came off from.
What's the best way to get the most boost out of a diving board?
All of that is timing. And that's something that that I learned through, my acrobatics and dance. One of my coaches, he kept saying, ride the board, ride the board, ride the board. And I asked him, well, what does it mean, ride the board? And so he said, well, when you push up into your hurdle, then you're going to hear the board bounce against the fulcrum, which is the adjustable rest of, where the board rests. He said, you'll hear the board bounce off the fulcrum twice, and then you'll come down on the board. And so the board became my music. I mean, that's the music that I would be listening to. And listening to the board, it's an even beat. So, you know the timing of that. And I would be able to make minute adjustments. Whether if I was coming down on the board too soon, I would lift my knees up just a little bit so I'd be in sync with the board. Not all divers learned to listen to the board, but I think that they're more aware of that now, because I just did it. I mean, being taught as a child, you don't have a perception of, much beyond yourself. So I thought everybody was doing it. It wasn't until later that I started getting into discussions with other divers that, I listened to the board, all the various cues that, that I would be taking in as I'm diving.
When you were competing in the Olympics and the judges would give you your score, did you ever feel that they were wrong?
No. Uh-huh. No, not at all. I mean, it was my job to convince the judges. If they saw something, I didn't really put a whole lot of focus on judges and judging.
Mm-hmm.
I let my coach worry about that. I mean, most of the time I was just out there performing. If they were being a little hard on me, then I had to, put that much more effort forward, to convince them otherwise.
So you've never been angry at a judge who you felt scored you too low?
No, No, not at all.
Do you ever watch performances of your dives?
Yeah.
What's that like?
It was funny because, when the Barbara Walters aired and I finally saw, and I can say this, these beautiful dives. I never could say that before. I'd look at my diving and it's like, oh, I was a little bit off here, a little bit off there. Oh, I didn't get my head, up far enough or something. I was really very critical. But when I saw the Barbara piece and, I saw beautiful diving.
What's changed? Do you think it's because you're not competing anymore that you can see the beauty of it now?
I don't know. I think it's just, it's been, I think, a long time coming. It was very compelling because I remember after my last dive in 1988, you know, I turned to my coach and I said, nobody will ever understand what we've just been through. And with the visuals and then the story that was really going on with me, underscoring the, you know, the visuals of this beautiful diving, it was pretty powerful, and it was close to getting a feel of what we had just been through.
One of the things your book has done is raise the question again, should professional athletes be tested for AIDS? Should Olympic athletes be tested for AIDS? The Olympic Commission said no, mm-hmm. we shouldn't be testing athletes. What do you think?
I think that's an individual decision, individual choice. I would encourage an athlete, if they are sexually active, to be tested. But that's all. But as far as mandatory testing, I'm opposed to that.
So for at least 6.5 or 7 years, you've been wondering what it would be like if people knew that you were HIV positive, and for a little less than that, you were wondering what it would be like if people knew you were gay. So now you're out, and the story's out that you're HIV positive. What's different for you? And does it feel better or worse? I know it's probably hard to tell, because being in the spotlight in the way that you are right now is a unique experience that's going to color any feeling that you have.
Well, I think... I think it's what I deal with in the introduction about no more secrets. I think that's very powerful. I hope this information... An acquaintance of my mom's approached her and said, Frances, you don't know this, but my daughter committed suicide because of an HIV diagnosis, and she left behind a son. And she said that I'd wished that she had lived long enough to hear me say what I had to say. I mean, it's, you know, too late for her, but hopefully, that message is getting out there that, you know, there is life after an HIV diagnosis.
Greg Louganis, he's written a new memoir called Breaking the Surface. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The U.S. is considering sending more troops to the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. It could be the next country pulled into the Balkan War.
Filmmaker Milcho Manchevski, a native of Macedonia, recently returned to make his film Before the Rain, about the imminence of war. The film has received an Academy Award nomination for Best Foreign Film. He'll talk with us about how things have changed there since he was a boy. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews an espionage novel called The Polish Officer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Senate has narrowly rejected the balanced budget amendment. It's a major defeat for the new Republican majority. Democratic opponents of the measure had wanted the GOP to put in strong provisions guarding Social Security from severe cuts. Senate Democratic leader Tom Daschle says if Republicans would come around, the measure would have passed.
Protect current and future Americans who are dependent upon Social Security, and we will find the votes to pass this amendment. We'll do it today. The Republicans said no. No, it's this amendment or no amendment at all.
The amendment was defeated by two votes, one by Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole. He used a procedural rule to make sure he can bring the amendment up again for a second vote. He's threatening to do it in the middle of next year's election cycle. Attorney General Janet Reno has defended the president's call for a review of affirmative action programs. She says her department will be playing a role in the assessment. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
The attorney general insists that the review will help people understand the country's civil rights laws and hopefully encourage support for them. Reno says it's clear that discrimination still exists in the United States, and she hopes the review will help head off efforts to dismantle needed programs.
What all of us are concerned about, the president, myself, and others, is that we do not use this as a wedge to divide this nation, but that we work together to make sure that the civil rights laws are enforced in a thoughtful, bipartisan tradition. We can make sure that affirmative action is a fair, proper tool to end discrimination in this country.
Civil rights leader Jesse Jackson has criticized the president's call for an assessment, suggesting yesterday that Democrats have been intimidated by the November election results. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
A Florida man convicted of the 1993 killing of a doctor who performed abortions now says he advocates peaceful protest and wants violence at clinics to stop. Debbie Elliott reports.
Michael Griffin has mailed a statement to abortion groups asking that clinic violence and illegal trespassing stop. In an interview published today in the Florida Times-Union, a Jacksonville newspaper, Griffin said he no longer believes that killing abortion providers is justifiable homicide. Griffin is serving a life sentence for the murder of Dr. David Gunn outside a Pensacola clinic in March of 1993. Since then, two other anti-abortion activists have been charged in the slayings of four people. Griffin says he changed his mind about using violence to stop abortion after reading the Bible and praying. He says he's still against abortion, but is trying to prevent violence around the abortion industry. Griffin is appealing his murder conviction, saying he was framed for Gunn's murder. For National Public Radio, I'm Debbie Elliott reporting.
On Wall Street in unofficial trading, the Dow lost about 15 points. This is NPR. A judge in Palermo, Italy, has ordered former Prime Minister Giulio Andreotti to stand trial on charges of being a full-fledged member of the Mafia. Regina Sansaloni reports from Rome.
After 6 hours of arguments from the defense and prosecution, Judge Agostino Cristina ordered the seven-time Prime Minister to stand trial in Palermo on September 26 on charges of being a mafioso. Prosecutors have submitted over 90,000 pages of evidence in which they accuse Andreotti, aged 76 and senator for life, of being a mafia member while head of state and protecting the crime organization in exchange for support of his Christian Democratic Party. The most explosive evidence comes from two informers who say they saw Andreotti give Salvatore Rina, the boss of bosses, a mafia kiss of honor in Palermo during a secret mafia summit. Andreotti, who attends mass every morning and enjoyed close Vatican ties while prime minister, emphatically denies all charges against him. For National Public Radio, this is Regina Sansaloni in Rome.
Heavy fighting is reported outside Chechnya's capital, Grozny. The region's rebel chief is again attacking Russian leaders, calling them common hoods. Chechen President Jokhar Dudayev says Moscow is trying to exterminate the Chechen people. Russian artillery has shelled two Grozny suburbs where separatist fighters have been held up. There is sniper fire in the city as well. Dudaev says the Chechen war will only get bigger, and he's warning Russian President Boris Yeltsin it could take 50 years to fight it. The director of the Russian Economic Analysis Institute says Moscow is spending $60 million a day to fight Chechen rebels. It's already spent $5 billion on the war. Administrators of the failed Barings Investment Bank say they're in exclusive talks with a large financial investment concern based in the Netherlands. The Dutch group could get Barings Brothers, the institution reportedly brought down last week by a young trader in Singapore. Nick Leeson, accused of destroying Barings, has been taken into custody in Germany. Singapore wants to extradite him. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before the Rain is one of the foreign films nominated for an Academy Award. The film is set in England and the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. Observers of the Balkan War say there's a danger the conflict may spread south to Macedonia. In fact, the U.S. is considering sending more military observers there. The director of Before the Rain, Milcho Manchevski, grew up in Macedonia but moved to the United States to attend film school in the late 70s. On a trip home in 1991, as Yugoslavia was crumbling, he decided to make a film about the premonition of war and the choices ordinary people must make in extraordinary situations. That film, Before the Rain, broke all box office records in Macedonia and won the Golden Lion Award at the Venice Film Festival. Fresh Air producer Naomi Person spoke to Milcho Manchevski and asked him to describe the film.
It's three stories. The first story is about a young monk who's taken a vow of silence and who finds this Albanian girl in his cell, and then he's sucked into a local conflict where he has to hide her and defend her, and then things happen from there. The second story is about a photo editor in an agency in London who's torn between her husband, her safe husband, and her lover, who's a bit off the wall, and who is a war photographer. And then the third story is about a war photographer who comes home because he spent all his life taking pictures of people's misery. So he wants to leave the war behind, but it follows him home. And now he has to take a stand, take a moral stand, make a decision, take a side. It was a story about expectations, about when there's something in the air and you know something big is going to happen. And this something could be cleansing, could be really good, could open new perspectives, or it could be terrible, it could be deadly and dangerous.
I'm curious about scenes in your film where people do die.
Mm-hmm.
I usually have a really hard time with violence in movies, but there was something quite beautiful, I thought, about the way you allowed people to die in your film. I don't know if that's a perverse thought on my part.
No.
But I'm curious what you did or what you drew from.
First of all, I mean, it doesn't happen all of a sudden. It doesn't. You're not just shot and then dead. It takes a while. A lot of victims, a lot of people who get shot, unless the heart or the brain are hit, it takes them a long time to die. So if you want to deal with some dimension of realism, you need to deal with this. You need to show it. I mean, you don't have to show a person dying on camera for 25 minutes, but this is something that you have to draw upon. So all of these people, it takes them a while to die. And it's not a heroic act. It's not the legendary, mythical, whatever you want to call it, act. It's just like you're coughing while you're dying, and you could be funny while you're dying, and you try to say something, but you stutter. It could be pathetic and comical at the same time, and ultimately it's sad. Even though beyond that sadness, there's a new life. Somebody else goes on.
Many of us, and most of us listening, can indulge in the luxury of distancing ourselves from a lot of the wars that are taking place in the world at this time. And sometimes I feel like I don't know how to absorb it all. You know, it's the wars are changing. There are countries that I'm oftentimes have not been familiar with. You want to learn about them. You want to absorb the situation. I'm wondering, how do you absorb it? How do you process it all?
You don't. You just don't. It happens to you, or it happens to your sister or to your cousin, and it's just there, and you get angry about it, and you try to do something about it. You go out and you burn down someone else's house, and you continue the circle, but I don't think you really understand what is happening, and I don't think you can really absorb it. At least I couldn't, and a lot of people whom I know who were involved in this war still don't quite understand it. I don't think the data and the information help you deal. I don't think they make you understand what is really happening, because it's really irrational. Mm-hmm. It's like getting more and more data about human behavior or about dreaming. And I mean, you can have all the data in the world, you're still not going to crack the Zen essence of it. So, I don't know. I mean, just violence and violence on such a large scale when there's peace everywhere else in the world, mm-hmm. Is completely surreal.
In the film, there is a section where there's a woman who works in a photo agency and her lover, who's this photojournalist. And you use a lot of real photos of war victims. Some of these photographs are photographs that one might even be familiar with because some of them were in newspapers. There's a photo of an emaciated prisoner of war, of women in a graveyard, of a child who's been, I believe, killed.
Yeah, they were all from Bosnia. Well, from ex-Yugoslavia, I think some were from Croatia, but mainly from Bosnia. Mm-hmm. That is our only link to reality. Everything else is acted and staged.
In these photographs, they are very moving. And I'm wondering if there was something that you saw in the victims' eyes or on their faces.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All the time.
What was that?
I don't know. I mean, discussing it, trying to verbalize it and to give it a personal mark is sort of embarrassing. It's like if you're a child and then someone asks you to someone catches you watching pornography and then you have to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. I was told that in one of the photographs that you use in the film, there's one that was staged, I believe.
Three, actually.
Oh, okay.
But they're a triptych. One comes out of the other.
Right. And I believe it's somebody who is getting shot.
Right. Right. And it's an execution, point-blank execution, which in this film, in the story, our main character, Alexander, sort of caused with his own, just because he needed a good picture. He started complaining to the militiaman, and he said, oh, no problem, here, I'll give you one. And he shoots a guy in front of his camera. Mm-hmm. And Alex takes those pictures, and that haunts him for the rest of his life.
And I understand that you are that person who's being shot.
Yeah, I was.
Why did you do that?
Well, I can give you a fancy answer, like an homage to Hitchcock or something. Mm-hmm. Or I can tell you that we ran out of extras on that day because the budget was very tight. So it was just the simplest thing to do at that point.
Uh-huh. How did it feel?
Very matter-of-factly, it was. We had our lunch break, and we had to have those photographs for the next day. So our unit photographer was going to take the pictures, go back and process them and stuff. It felt a little awkward because it was a real gun pointed. It was like a few inches from my head. And our armor from Bulgaria was very much, he got carried away by the part, so he kept shooting in my head. we repeated it a few times, and most of the pictures were blurry, but they did the job.
Mm-hmm. Did it weird you out to see them in the film and to keep working with them as you were editing the film?
No. I it's a nice provocation, I think.
Mm-hmm. You're well adjusted.
Our guest is Milcho Manchevsky, director of the new film Before the Rain. Back after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring an interview with Milcho Manchevsky, director of Before the Rain. He's speaking with Fresh Air producer Naomi Person.
I'm wondering if it felt dangerous for you making the film in Macedonia. The actor who plays Alexander is a Serbian who lived in exile from Croatia, and there had been threats on his life at one time.
Right. That's Rade Šerbedžija, who plays the part of Alexander. Well, the threats and the danger that he felt, all of that happened outside of Macedonia, funny enough. Mm-hmm. It happened in Croatia, where he spent all his life, and in Serbia, where he moved afterwards, because he's Serbian. I don't know. I mean, I guess for people who came to Macedonia for the first time, it must have felt a little awkward, maybe a little eerie, because there was a war just over the mountains or a couple hundred miles away. I was too absorbed in the process to think of the danger. For me, we had the danger of the completion bond company pulling the plug, because we couldn't insure the film. The war insurance was practically as high as the entire budget of the film. They gave us 5 scenarios of how war could start in Macedonia while we were shooting this film, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So in the end, everyone who came there, the entire crew and parts of the cast that who came from the UK and from France and from other parts of Europe to work there, they, after about a week or two, they relaxed. I mean, it felt sort of like Jamaica without the sea. Which is one of the contrasts that I'm interested in, maybe in the next film, if there is a next film. It's just that that sense of the war being over the mountain, yet here you're having more fun than people in the village are going to have.
Mm-hmm. The sections of the film that take place in Macedonia are in rural landscapes. Where did you grow up in Macedonia?
I grew up in Skopje, which is the biggest urban area, the biggest city in Macedonia, which is something like, I don't know, 700,000 people now or mm-hmm. thereabout. So working on the film and scouting for locations was, for me, a way of discovering the country where I grew up. So all of the landscapes you see in the film are as new and as interesting to me as they would be to, I guess, someone who grew up in London.
Mm-hmm.
I just never bothered with the countryside. I spent my time in the city. I had a mohawk when I was a teenager.
Oh, really? To somebody who's never been there before, what is Skopje like?
Well, it's like any capital city of a developing ex-communist third world southern European country.
Go on.
Well, it has its share of high rises, its share of slums, and in this case, gypsies who live in the slums. There were people who asked why we didn't see any Mercedes or BMW cars in the film, since there is quite a few of them around Skopje. And then we decided that it just wasn't a film about Mercedes and BMW cars.
Mm-hmm. Before you made Before the Rain, you made some music videos. One of them was Tennessee for the group Arrested Development, which won an MTV award and a Billboard award in 1992. I'm learning, what did you learn from making videos that you put into feature films?
Well, I learned to be efficient. To be efficient in pragmatic terms, meaning in dealing with your time and your budget and your crew, and also to be efficient in terms of what you're saying, what you have in your frame, how much story you can tell without using dialogue. So I entered music videos hoping that they would be a great ground to make experimental films. I was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But out of it, I learned all of this very useful, both pragmatic and creative stuff.
Why couldn't you make the films that you wanted to with music?
The experimental films?
Yeah.
Because it's basically a commercial medium, and it's about whether the act, the singer, the band look good or not. It's not about the abstract shapes you want to show or the story you want to tell.
You live in New York now?
Yes.
I believe. Yeah.
Well, I have for the last almost 10 years.
Uh-huh. And are you going back and forth now between Skopje and New York?
Yeah, it's a long commute.
Uh-huh. How long?
I don't know, a few thousand miles.
Uh-huh. And how's that working out? I mean, do you go into culture shock each way and besides jet lag?
Actually, it's quite good because when I get back here, I'm really happy I'm in New York. I feel like I'm back home, and the same thing happens when I go back to Macedonia. So it's like a double whammy. It's good, but it's not practical, and it's not going to last.
So you will have to make a choice.
Yeah.
And do you know what you're going to choose?
Not yet. I don't know.
Well, good luck.
Thanks.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Very, very welcome.
Milcho Manchevsky directed the new film Before the Rain. It's one of the Oscar nominees for Best Foreign Film. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Naomi Person. This is Fresh Air. The balanced budget amendment was defeated in the Senate today. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll hear from the Senate what happened and how it was that supporters of a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution never did come up with that two-thirds majority. They actually fell one vote shy, and then Majority Leader Dole changed his vote in the end for parliamentary reasons, so it looks like it's two votes shy. Also on today's program, a reaction from the states from our reporter Don Gagne, a story on lobbying and food stamps, and lobbying on Capitol Hill, that is. We'll also be hearing about desktop photography, hearings on the National Endowments for the Arts and the Humanities, and a talk with the skipper of the boat that's leading in the America's Cup races, Young America.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The end of the Cold War was supposed to spell curtains for the espionage novel, but it's proven to be a never-say-die form. John le Carré has a new book out this month, as does Alan First, a younger generation spy master whose previous two novels, Night Soldiers and Dark Star, have earned him a lot of enthusiastic fans. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has just finished First's The Polish Officer, and she says it's put her in a Casablanca state of mind.
A book review editor I know once told me her method for dealing with the avalanche of new books which poured into her office every week. She said she'd close her eyes and run her fingers over the book jacket. If any embossed bosoms popped out, meaning the book was a romance novel, it was discarded. I didn't ask how she felt about embossed swastikas, mostly because I didn't want to acknowledge my own cherished collection of World War II spy novels. Pleasure alone is an awkward literary value to defend, and though I could have made some feeble case for learning history from Eric Ambler, Frederick Forsyth, and Ken Follett, that's not why I read them. It's for the sheer excitement of outwitting the Nazis and enjoying all the other adventures of the good war without any of its consequences. There's also a special tingle for me in the act of going undercover as a male operative in this high testosterone world of disguises and betrayals. Though it's not as cool for them to admit it, a lot of men secretly read romance novels for these very same transgressive thrills. Alan First's latest novel, The Polish Officer, has everything it takes to feed my anti-Führer fantasies. The novel opens in the wrong place at the wrong time, Poland, September 1939. As German troops machine gun their way into Warsaw, a band of Polish military intelligence officers gathers to frantically burn maps. One of them, a captain named Alexander Demilia, is offered a no-win proposition. He can remain with his comrades and be killed within hours, or he can continue fighting the war underground and be killed within months. Demilia takes the bait, becomes a spy, and for an amateur, catches on quick to the one rule of survival. Anything could be done, he tells himself, but you had to think it through, concentrate. A life of evasion had the same given as always. It hadn't changed in centuries. They could make 1,000 mistakes. You couldn't make one. Most good spy stories are plot-driven, but only the best induce this many high-anxiety moments of suspended breathing. Demilia begins his career by hijacking a train and smuggling the Polish bullion reserves out of the country. He then moves to Paris, where he helps thwart Operation Sea Lion, the German plan to invade Great Britain. And he ends up in Russia in the bitter winter of 1941, where he breaks into a Soviet prison and emerges with a crucial secret and the SS hot on his trail. All this probably sounds a little much, but first, scrupulous attention to spycraft and period detail makes his story easy to swallow. Like Louis Bagley's haunting 1991 novel about occupied Poland, Wartime Lies, the Polish officer evokes the mood of conquered cities like Warsaw, Paris, and Barcelona, all of them invaded by the silence that passed for peace, the courtesy of fear. Please, I'd like you to hear this again. The silence that passed for peace, the courtesy of fear. Language this lovely vaults the categories we lazily constrain literature with.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Polish Officer by Alan First. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Roberta Shurrock, with Nancy Updike and Alan Tu, who also directed today's show. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Our interns are Sienna Chrisman and Zeb Esselstyn. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from Ferrer, Strauss & Giroux, publisher of Laurie Garrett's The Coming Plague, Newly Emerging Diseases in a World Out of Balance. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Said I many times, love is illusion.
Tony Bennett won 2 Grammys this week, including Album of the Year. We'll feature an interview with him on the next archive edition of Fresh Air. Also, Jeff Moss performs songs he wrote for Sesame Street. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
So sure, so positive, so utterly unchangingly certain that I never was aware.